Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. Tonight's guest will be Tim Ritter, and if you bear with me, I am going to be calling him. This is the way I have to do it in order to get it to work, so just bear with me for, less than a minute, and we will be talking with him soon. And I am going to dial now. And once again, it will be Tim Ritter. And if you watch horror movies, I'm sure you know Tim Ritter. He's like a real big deal in horror movies. Hello, Tim. Can you hear me okay?
I seem to hear you. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, that's actually a good thing because there have been times where I had to call people like 5 or 6 times before they could hear me. So,
oh, really?
We're doing good already. Yeah, we're doing
that's
good already.
True. Cool.
And so how are you doing tonight, Tim?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, just peachy keen, like they used to say back in the old days. I never said that. But
somebody had to, though. Well, it's kind of reflecting on a lot.
So we might as well just get right into it. Now, I know you were really young when you started out because you were – your first credit on IMDb was for Day of the Reaper. And since that was 1984, you would have only been 17 years old. And
right.
You were, yeah, you did the screenplay, you were the director, and you were the editor. And then I also want to mention the second movie, and then you can just talk about both of them if that's okay with you. And then mm-hmm. Right about the same time was Twisted Illusions, which you were the producer, the writer, the director, the editor, the location management, the casting director. Yeah, you were really getting your indie movie chops there. So I would like you to discuss those two movies and what it was like to get started so young.
Okay. Well, I guess it kind of all began with the Family Super 8 movie camera. And, you know, when I started using that, when I saw that I could record images and everything, I'd always written before that. You know, I was a little kid creating stories. It was just kind of a natural progression. Always was creative, always, you know, doing storylines and that kind of thing. So when I saw the Super 8 movie camera, I said, oh, hey, I can make my own movies inspired by, you know, Jaws, Star Wars, and eventually later Hammer movies, Halloween, you know, all those kind of cool things as they got along. But I think the earliest one, Day of the Reaper, was just a kind of a product of a kid in the back of the classroom in high school reading Fangoria magazine and being influenced by those articles, Herschel Gordon Lewis, John Waters, Wes Craven, you know, his early work like The Hills Have Eyes and later Last mm-hmm. House on the Left, which didn't come out on video. I didn't see it at that time. But I read about all that stuff in the H.G. Lewis movies and that kind of stuff. And so it was just... you know, I'd already made Super 8 movies, and we saw that video stores, mom-and-pop stores, were kind of like going to be the new drive-ins. So it was like, well, we can make, because before Day of the Reaper, I'd already made probably 30 Super 8 movies of various lengths. Started out at 4 minutes, graduated up to 8 and 32. And I think we did a couple that were about 45 minutes. And then Day of the Reaper was the big jump to do at least. Let's do a feature-length movie with original music instead of culling it from soundtracks that we love, you know, on vinyl and trying to sync all that up on a cassette. Two alien names now, except for diehard collectors, I'm sure. And then, you know, Day of the Reaper was shot on Super 8 film. I think I started when I was 16, and then by the time I finished, I might have turned 17. I can't even remember now, but it was in that junior year in high school, I believe. And it was during that summer, and we shot, you know, in the heat of the summer in Florida. And at that point, the idea was to take the entire finished movie, transfer it to a beta videotape at high school, sync up some kind of sound with it. And of course I was watching movies like Pieces. So it didn't matter to me if the dialogue didn't match and everything was out of sync. To me, that was kind of normal for a, you know, low budget horror type movie. And, you know, I used people that were in the drama class, and I actually got a grade on it because a lot of the stuff, a lot of the special effects and the props and, you know, putting it all together through the drama and art departments, like the head at the end where the creature gets his head chopped off, that I think I got a B on that. It was like a big, some kind of porcelain or something you make. Everybody else was making vases, and there I was making a Belial basket case inspired head, you know, for the end of this movie. So, you know, then the plan for me for that was I took out a full page ad in the War Cry, which was the Jupiter High School newspaper. And I was also a staff member there. And I actually reviewed my own movie, which sounds insane because I was like the film critic. And of course I gave it like 4 stars going, "This is the greatest horror movie you've ever seen." And then, you know, we went around and sold it. We made photocopied slip covers and went around to like local video stores saying, "Hey, this is made locally." And, you know, it might rent out because, you know, there'll be like local interest in it. People will like to see at least the locations. So, you know, as a kid, teenager going in, you know, I guess a lot of video stores felt sorry for me. And you know, that's how kind of Day of the Reaper kind of started. It was just an idea. Instead of just showing the Super 8 movies in the living room to neighborhood kids, it was like, oh, I can get this out into, you know, the adult world and compete with Hollywood and the little video movies here. And then selling that movie, Twisted Illusions, came about because I reconnected with Joel Weinkoop, who was actually my babysitter when he's about 4 or 5 years older than me. And he also had a Super 8 movie camera, and that goes back to the 70s, so he was an influence as well. I was in some of his movies, but he reconnected to me based on his nephew saw the War Cry ad in the newspaper, and he said, "Hey, I want to help do this." So we got together, and then I was like going, yeah, and he helped me sell Day of the Reaper, and then in the process of that, we met another guy who was at this chain of video stores called Video Extron that was Al Nicolosi, and he worked at a TV station. So as you can see, everything was kind of coming. You're just selling the movies, and then you're reconnecting with Joel, who also wanted to produce and mainly act, so I had like an adult actor because he was like in his early 20s. And then I met Al Nicolosi, who just had his own video company, which I began to work with, called Video Events. And it did commercials, weddings, you know, industrial movies. So I started hanging out with him, and he worked at an ABC television station in the midnight shift. So I started working with him and working for him. And Joel, Al, and I went off and made Twisted Illusions, which was kind of an anthology movie, like Twilight Zone meets Creepshow with no budget, of course. And, you know, we each did 3 segments each. And this time I was able to shoot on 3/4-inch and 1/2-inch video and finally have synchronized sound and another original music score by Sean Rudney, the guy who did the score for Day of the Reaper. And so we did the same thing, only, you know, I had 2 adults with me who were giving me a little bit of credibility and a lot, you know, as just far as having adult actors in, you know, Twisted Illusions, as opposed to, you know, 15-year-olds acting like they're 30. So that was, pretty, you know, for that. And then again, we went around and sold copies of Twisted Illusions to video stores. And they were pretty receptive, you know, in that process of, again, going into the video store going, "Hey, I'm a local movie maker. Check this movie out. It's shot locally. We got local actors in it." You know, it was enough for the interest to be there. And from there, the chain of distribution, there was like used van drivers and guys who would go around and trade tapes to different stores. So we got involved with them where they were buying 10 to 20 copies. So eventually these tapes started to float not only on South Florida, you know, like South Florida, but further up into Georgia, eventually into New York, and then later in California. And so, you know, it wasn't huge numbers, but it was enough that suddenly, you know, these trading guys were getting our tapes around. So that's kind of how it all started as I was getting ready to graduate from high school. And at that point, just to probably fold into the next thing, one of the stories in Twists and Illusions that I wrote and directed was called Truth or Dare. And it was just a short story about a man's wife who leaves him, and he goes crazy and plays the game Truth or Dare, self-mutilation and all that. Everybody seemed to like that movie because, spoiler, at the end, it turned out that, you know, he was torturing himself, and all these characters that were taunting him to hurt himself were imaginary friends, and he gets put in an asylum at the end. So basically that the reception to that was so good and so awesome from everybody who saw the movie that we said, hey, what if we took this and made it into a feature-length script? So that's what I worked on in my senior year in high school, making that movie, that short, into a full-length script that we could kind of shop around or get financed locally. And that's how everything kind of started and slowly began to fall in place from like 1984 through late 85, I would say.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, because that the one you're talking about, that was Truth or Dare, A Critical Madness, right?
Correct, yes. That's what the short from Twisted Illusions, eventually, I wrote that script into a full-length feature script, and that would be the next one after that.
Cool. Yeah, I just think that it's really, really, like, amazing that you sold your first professional script when you were 17 years old. That's just, like, a big deal. And then you got to direct the movie adaptation of what you wrote when you were 18 years old. I mean, that had to be a big rush.
It definitely was. It was, a real exciting time. From coming from a Super 8 movies to, from nowhere, no connections in the business or anything like that. It was just kind of an underdog story because I, for some reason I just could not take no for an answer. So when we eventually connected with a company that was, very interested, it was a company out of Northbrook, Illinois, Video Swap International, and they were affiliated with the Van guys. And they were like, yeah, we want to release a direct-to-video horror movie. And I sent them Twisted Illusions, and they carried a few of those. And I said, look, I got the one story in there. I got a script for it. And they were like, yeah, we're very interested in doing this. And so, long story short, I spent an entire summer just kind of courting this company, sending the materials. We did Al Nicolosi and I did a videotape that presented what we wanted to do, how, we researched video sales of movies like Blood Feast, Dawn of the Dead, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how many units they would have sold, what we planned to do, who we were, how we had our actors. At the time, Miami Vice was going in Florida. So we had a casting director who worked with them, and we held auditions in North Palm Beach that drew from people who were in Miami Vice's show and, all the stuff they were doing down there. So we had literally hundreds of people on videotape that were, and we were doing all this for free on a dime. We were like, oh, hey, we're making this movie with or without you. At that point, we were prepared to use credit cards. We were going to shoot it on video. We were going to go locally and just get some money. Anyway, we were just going to do it. And so, again, Al Nicolosi and I, it ended up where the president of the company, Jeffrey Miller, said, hey, next time you're in the area, just drop by. And I was like, what? We've been negotiating for months. And I was like, okay, I'll be in the area next week. And he was like kind of surprised. And he said, oh, okay. So, I was like, oh, we're going to take this to the end. So Al and I flew up there on our, our own money. And they had like a pink limousine pick us up. It was kind of bizarre because they were also in the adult business. So they were, selling those kind of movies as well. And they had a movie called Vegetable House that was a direct-to-video comedy. I think SCTV was one of the first of those. So, we went up there and we met with him, and he was very impressed, I guess, at just our ambition and tenacity of like, yeah, I'll be in the area. I know I'm down in Florida, but I just happen to be coming right by your place, next week. So we sat down with him, had a good meeting, laid everything out. And long story short, he was impressed enough with all the material we had given him, the movies we had made, and kind of gotten out into the market from nowhere, and then, coming up there and saying, hey, look, here's everything. Here's the prospectus, here's the script, here's the financing video. We got casting. I had all the locations, lined up. At that time, I was just reading books endlessly on how to make movies. This was before the luxury of DVDs where people can look at their favorite movie, watch a 5-hour making of segment on it with interviews from everybody and, all that great history,
right,
which is so wonderful. But, then you'd have to read the magazines and the books, and that's what I was kind of immersed in. And I was just like going, okay, we're set up. And eventually, trial and error. Eventually they did end up, you know, financing the movie for, and they got one of the producers who had worked on Death Wish to help produce. And they got the special pyrotechnic guy who did Ghostbusters and Code of Silence, and so, you know, a nice stunt team, and the budget escalated way beyond, you know, what we had anticipated in the next, you know, 3 or 4 months. So it was pretty cool. Pretty good high school graduation, you know, that summer is pretty much when it was like trial by fire on getting a movie into production from nothing. And then actually the film school was the next 6 months making the movie and learning as much as I could on my own project, kind of from nowhere. So it was definitely very surreal.
Yeah, it sounds like it was quite a wild ride in your teen years there.
Yes. It happens. I've heard other people have had good, you know, some good luck, but it's very rare.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that you are able to do something that, you know, I think, yeah, I don't know what other examples are, but I mean, I know there's people who have started out pretty young.
There are lots. One thing that I wanted to ask you, and I know it probably gets asked a lot, but I really don't care because I like to find out the answer. Because I know in indie filmmaking, especially if you want to make your own films and not like just be an actor in them, and you want to do more like produce and direct and stuff like that, you take on lots of hats. And you are no different. You have been a producer, a writer, director, actor, cinematographer, editor, location management, casting director. You've even done special effects and a bunch of stuff that I'm not even mentioning because it would take some extra time. But of all of those, sorry, that's my housemate's phone ringing.
Oh, that's all right.
It's pretty loud. It's pretty loud.
Sounds like something out of Miami Vice. Yeah, I can hear it. It's good. Sounds like a busy office.
So, anyway, my question was, if you have a favorite, which is your favorite hat to wear?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I'm so used to kind of doing and, you know, having a hand in everything. Just, you know, and it's also whoever comes to the project with you and collaborates well, but sometimes you'll get people who don't, you know, do as much as you had hoped for, or they get busy or drop out, so you end up having to do all that. But I mean, you know, I like writing and, you know, that part, and directing is really fun, where you just get to kind of use everybody's talents to the best of their ability. And you know, the different directors direct different ways, but I tend to just kind of, you know, let everybody just have creative fun, and then I'll just pick the best thing of what they're offering. And then, you know, together we figure out, you know, how to do a shortcut and make something out of nothing pretty much, and have a creative good time. So directing is fun, and writing, very solitude, you know, that can be really fun too, where you don't have to worry about the scheduling and all that, and editing. So, you know, I would say those three, directing, editing, and writing are, you know, always my favorites.
Well, like I've said on other shows, an editor can make or break a movie. So editing is a very important job.
Right. And it's hard to be a good editor for, you know, stuff you've shot yourself, because you tend to want to leave it all in there. You're like, oh, no, that's great. I got to leave. So you're getting it really harsh when you edit your own, you know, videography or film, you know.
If it's okay with you to move on, because I'm pretty sure you were done talking. There's a slight overlap, so I can't always tell when a person is done talking.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
That's good.
All right. Because I was going to go to, like, well, the 90s and talk about probably at least a couple movies from the 90s. Because you have so many credits that it's just there's way too much to go through, and no way that it could be done in an hour. So I'm just like
that's
picking
true.
And choosing. But one movie that I know that was really popular with people and that you are really known for is the movie Creep that you wrote. And so I don't know what else you did for that particular movie, but I do know that you wrote it. So how did that all come about with writing it and then actually putting it together as a movie? Or did you intend for it to be a movie?
Creep was it was after Wicked Games, and that was one I ended up Creep I did write and direct. And I was on a radio show in Fort Lauderdale promoting Wicked Games Truth or Dare Part 2. And long story short, we were looking to do our next project, and I had a script called that I was trying to, you know, get going for the next movie as we were, you know, getting ready to promote, distribute, and release Wicked Games. And at that point, we had created our own distribution company with Killing Spree. So we had Killing Spree already out and Wicked Games, and I did a radio show in Fort Lauderdale with Herschel Gordon Lewis, which was really cool. Got to meet him. And,
wow.
You know, it was like a three-hour show, and I brought my amazing Herschel Gordon Lewis book for him to sign. And Jeff Willits, Kathy Willits' husband, heard the show and also saw, I guess, in the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, they had a spotlight on Wicked Games, because we got a lot of publicity down there in Florida. You know, in the day, pre-internet, of course, magazines and newspapers were your and news programs were, you know, your main way to get notoriety, make connections, hopefully get investors. And that was the day, instead of Indiegogo, you would have to go out and raise money through a limited partnership. So, again, this is, you know, many years after even Truth or Dare, where I learned all this stuff, and it was very difficult because you didn't even have, well, I guess you had limited liability companies, but they weren't used the way, as easy to set up as they were now. So you would have to go through this entire incorporation thing, which took a long time to put together, and all kinds of red tape and all that stuff. But then, so Jeff Willits contacted me and said, hey, how would you like to have a, and he even, he just called me out of the blue and he said, hey, this is Ted. I have a major celebrity for you. And I was like, going, oh, really? You know, at this point, a lot of people were, you know, making crank calls, and you get a lot of strange individuals calling up going, hey, I want to be in a movie. I can get an A-list person for you, you know, whatever. But it turned out it was, you know, later he called back and he said, you know, my wife is Kathy Willits, America's favorite nymphomaniac. And at the time she was one of those, Kathy Willits was one of the scandalous celebrities. She was on Prozac. I guess they got caught. The story was she got caught being a prostitute, and Jeff was filming her in the closet, and there were some politicians involved, and then a big scandal, and then one of her legal defenses was that she was on Prozac. And this is probably a 90s thing that now hardly anybody remembers, but, you know, there's a scandalous celebrity now, like, probably every week, but back then it was like, one a year, maybe, or one every 6 months, you know, like Joey Buttafuoco and whoever, you know, would be like, you know, the ones that Current Affair would latch on to. So anyway, they said, yeah, we'd like to, you know, do a movie. We just got out of jail. We're starting some kind of tour on the club circuit. She'd like to do, she was going to do adult films, but we'd like to put our hand in a horror movie. You look like a local guy that can help us get some, you know, better publicity. And I was like, so I went to another guy, another producer that I had met down there and worked on Wicked Games, Michael Ornelas, and we put together a package, and, you know, we got the price, you know, what she would cost, and everything kind of, they had a short window where they wanted to do it. I think this was like 1994, this was in January, February 1994. So we had a meeting with them in March. We read her, did a test screening. We went to a lawyer. We put together a package where we could, you know, get all this together. We got the limited partnership together. Got a few investors, and then it was like, what are we going to film with her? So then I took the script, the Creep that I was writing, and kind of formulated it into a new script that kind of tailored for her character. And we ended up shooting, you know, the movie with a lot of the people that were in Wicked Games. We just kind of carried them over. And we ended up shooting that in probably October 1994. And then it came out and in 1995. So, but Kathy Willis was great to work with, and you know, the script was really had a lot of action in it. We had recycled props, and it was just something we put together very fast, as best as we could. And even though it was larger budget for a video movie, it was still pretty small. I think we ended up spending under $20,000 on the whole thing. And we shot with 3-chip Super VHS cameras and also some Beta. Did a little bit of film work on it. We had a big scene where a building blew up, and I just, you know, all kinds of shortcuts by then. By then I was into Roger Corman and, you know, all these other guys who started out and done stuff on the sly, kind of guerrilla filmmaking. So I just showed up at the, they're going to blow up this Breakers Hotel in Palm Beach. And I took my old high school, press pass. And I was like, I got it in the press area and I got my video cameras out. We had another guy that had a 16mm camera. He went over and got another. And so we got this huge building being demolished and we're able to incorporate that into the movie and the ending, which was kind of cool. So just stuff like that kind of elevated this very small movie into, you know, a larger looking production, even though it was still shot on video, analog video. And of course, Kathy Willits at that time, she was getting in trouble. She had some kind of stage act where she got put in jail again and then ended up on Geraldo. And it just became a very big thing while we're shooting. Current Affair flew in and did a, you know, like a national a spotlight on us filming the movie. So that was great. And then we had all these magazines that, you know, came in and did articles on us, and so it kind of really blew up into something bigger. And it was, you know, my thought was, you know, Herschel Gordon Lewis used Connie Mason and Blood Feast, so I was like going, you know, who am I to deny the opportunity to use, you know, a celebrity to try to promote, you know, a horror movie in Florida, you know, many years later, 1993, to, you know, do something similar. So worked out kind of good. You know, the making of the actual movie and everything went very smooth, and, you know, it was a lot of fun, so.
Good. Yeah, I know that a lot of people liked that movie. Now, personally, that's one of the ones I haven't seen. And that happens, you know, if you don't see it available anywhere, you can't watch it. So that's
right,
one of
right.
the few that I haven't seen. But
right,
sure
well, it had a bigger VHS release than DVD, so that's probably, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's got a limited edition Blu-ray, and it's been released on regular DVD for a while, but it was, you know, lower numbers, so it is harder to find these days, so.
Yeah, because when they're small numbers, and then in different areas, they don't get a lot of things, because, like, when I was growing up in the well, you know, depending on which decade we're talking about. But I was born in 1960. So around the 70s and the 80s when the VHS started becoming really, really popular, well, Beta and VHS, and the video stores and everything, in Ohio, we didn't get a lot of things that were made in Hollywood because they just didn't send them to Ohio.
As far as that,
until like several years later, we would get them. So
right.
whenever a movie came out, we were running to the video stores to get them because we were sure that they'd sell out, which they actually did. Every time they bought movies and were selling them, they sold out like hotcakes.
Oh, wow. Well, that's cool.
Yeah. Now, what I wanted to do since, I mean, we still got plenty of time. We've got a little over half an hour. But I wanted to make sure that we went over some more recent stuff. And then if there's time left, then we can go back and go over some older stuff or, you know, whatever. But I know that you've got two things in the works, or at least I'm pretty sure I know. You've got one that's still filming, and that's High Fear. And
right,
you're the editor, cinematographer, director, writer, and producer. So if you want to talk about that a little bit, like what's it about, you know, what
okay.
you've got done so far.
Well, that movie is kind of, I think it's kind of in post-production, and we're still filming some things with it. But it's a collaboration with Brad and Josephina Sykes. out of California, Nightfall Productions, and it's like Twisted Illusions. It's another anthology movie where three or four different writer-directors make a segment, and I think this time each one's going to be about 30 minutes long. I know Todd Sheets has contributed one, and of course Brad Sykes has done one, and I've done one, and I think we've got one or two more people that are going to do one. And there'll be a wraparound story that, that Brad does as well. And this is kind of High Fear is the third in the series that started out with the anthology movie High Eight, which was kind of a cheap, I guess, answer to VHS. I don't know if you're familiar with VHS, the anthology movie that was pretty successful probably about eight years ago or something like that. So, yeah, we were talking on social media on Tony Masiello's Shot on Video Facebook page. We were all just talking about nothing. I think it was near New Year's Eve 2012 or something like that, and it was like we were just talking about VHS and how they really didn't include any of the, you know, directors who really worked in video in the analog days. And I was like, well, why not just do a pint-sized version of you know, VHS, and we'll call it High Eight, and it kind of stuck. And then we all were talking about it, and it ended up, we call, you know, High Eight stands for like a horror independent eight. So we had eight people who worked in video or were coming into video and loved the analog stuff from, you know, the now the old days, and everybody made a 10-minute segment, and it was and it was pretty successful. Released by Wild Eye Entertainment. And then we just released the sequel about a year ago, High Death, and again it had some of the same contributors, and it upped the ante a little bit. Though we didn't stick with analog this time, we went with high definition, and now we're, you know, doing High Fear, where we're just kind of three or four of the filmmakers, movie makers left, you know, that have time to do, you know, the anthology stuff here. We're just kind of trying to go out on a high note and really deliver something that is, you know, the best we can do with almost nothing. So so High Fear comes out. My segment's called When Shadows Come Alive, and it's really cool. It's got lots of gore in it and lots of local cool actors from Lexington, Kentucky. Michelle Macabre, a.k.a. Shannon Stockin. She's a special effects person in it. She takes a role in it. She's got a great scene with a snake in it, which, spoiler, but you know, when you see the movie, it like comes out of her mouth. And it basically, it's about this kind of group of people in the woods, like the hills have eyes, that encounter these other people who are doing something they shouldn't be doing. And they all kind of converge there, and there's a big kind of battle of survival in the wilderness. So, and it's also kind of a little homage to Hills Have Eyes and Deliverance. So, so that's in post-production now, and it should be coming out, of course, depending on, you know, what's going on with the, you know, world things and film fests and everything. The other two movies have went international on the, you know, film fest stuff before landing on, you know, DVD and Blu-ray and streaming, but hopefully sometime late this year or in 2021, you know, it'll get some kind of release. Everything's just really way behind in the entertainment business, of course, with all the things going on right now. So that one's pretty heavy in the end of post-production. We're hoping to wrap it up by October.
Oh, good. I love anthology films, so that'll be one that I'll be watching.
Cool.
One of the other ones... It sounds like it. Sounds like it's going to be really good. I also know that you're doing, I mean, I don't know exactly what you're doing. I do know some things that you're doing on Joel D. Weinkoop's The Kreglan Incident. And you're acting in it, executive producer, and then you also composed some music for that?
Oh, did I compose music? I could have. I don't know.
Well, that's what it says on IMDb.
Was,
if you don't remember, then you
Well, and when Joel and I make movies, we recycle a lot of things because you know, there's no budget, so we recycle special effects, music cues. So you know, we end up giving each other credits if it's something we did in the past that we kind of regurgitate for a current project. But yeah, Joel is always you know, always on the move and always moving forward. And I think this is the movie he said it's a science fiction movie where him and a few other people. Actress Kathy Weinkoop. She is in it as well. I think you interviewed her last week or a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And they were kind of cooped up in the COVID world, and I think they were also doing that Roger Corman challenge. And he started to do a short, and then it just kind of grew from there, and he got other movie makers involved and other people, you know, everybody excited about it. So he kind of reached out to everybody and said, hey, everybody, I want to get everybody that's, you know, in the scene that's kind of not able to shoot much because, you know, it's been like everybody's kind of just been not able to do what they want, whether it's big or small. And so everybody kind of contributed parts to it. I know Phil Herman, he shot some scenes for Joel. And I did a cameo for him for something on the, I guess it's like a super Skype screen where everybody's, you know, talking about, you know, what they're going to do about this alien invasion. So it's kind of a cool idea. So his project just kind of grew and grew and grew. And I think, you know, they're working on it now. And I think he's supposed to have it done by mid-August. So it should be a pretty interesting little movie.
Yeah, I've been keeping track of that because I understand the you know, what brought it about, because what else are you going to do? You can't like really make a movie the way that it should be made because of the social distancing, so you do what you can, you film what you can as far as filming somebody, but you have to stay 6 feet away from them at least,
right?
And really,
and wear a mask. I was like, is everybody's movie? I was like going, I need to get a Tom Cruise lookalike, and I'll just put a mask over him, and I'll say it's Tom Cruise, and we'll leave the mask on him for, you know, I'll be like, yes, it's Tom Cruise, K-R-O-O-S-E.
Yeah, and I think it's going to do well, and I think because of this pandemic that we're all going through, I mean, nobody is exempt from it, that we'll be able to relate.
Definitely. Definitely going
to
be fun.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just going to be a fun project when it's all put together.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. Now, one thing I wanted to talk about, and it probably won't be for long, because, I mean, unless you had something else to say about those two movies, because I don't want to presume that you're done talking.
No. Yeah, you said, let's see, yeah, we got a couple other movies. I'm going to do kind of a Sharknado-style movie for SRS Cinema this summer, hopefully, if all that comes through. We're just trying to put that together now. And got a couple other small projects that are in the works with Michelle Macabre. We're doing those. Like I said, I met her a couple years ago when she moved to Kentucky. And we started on the High Fear one, and then we've just kind of been, you know, doing everything that we can under, you know, with limited funds, and then now all the worldwide things happening. So, well, you can keep track of those on the Facebook pages where, you know, I make announcements once we. But again, it's all probably shooting this year. Nothing will probably be out till 2021 for sure.
So you're just kind of like in pre-production mainly? With
pretty
the
much,
things
yeah.
That you're talking about.
Yeah. Right. We got some in post-production and then a few in pre-production. So.
Well, you're keeping busy, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now, I just want to make sure, is there anything that you want to say about your newer projects? Because I like to give my guest, obviously, all the time they want to talk about something, and I just like kind of direct where it's going. So really, whatever they want to talk about, you know, meaning you, go ahead. If you have anything else to say about your newer works, be my guest.
Well, we recently collaborated with Tony Masiello on a movie called Zombarella. And that one's it's pretty much his movie. And again, it's like an anthology movie. And it's kind of his life's work because he's a shot-on-video fan. And he has made a bunch of shorts. And he put all of these shorts together and then made it with USA Up All Night ads, you know, mock ads and all that kind of stuff. And it deals with a director named, I think, Fred Olin Wood. And it's about his movies. And it's like watching like a USA Up All Night broadcast with, instead of features, there's like, you know, short movies. And we contributed a short to that and some of the commercials and that stuff. Michelle Macabre and Katrina and I, we all did that. So that is available now, and that's on his Shot on Video website. And then we did, last summer at this time, we were filming, believe it or not, in August, Santa Kills, which is part of the Wave Video movie Gift Wrapped and Gutted, and also a book on Christmas movies, which came out last December, but we were filming it now. And we did like the 4-minute intro for that, which did real well. And I'm sure this holiday it'll see a re-release. And we also did a rock video for Savage Master. And that's, you can see that on YouTube, Myth, Magic, and Steel. So that's got a lot of cool special effects with all the same people I'm talking about that I collaborate with here in Kentucky. So Michelle Macabre, Tony Masiello out in California, he does some of the virtual special effects, and all our cool local actors like Thomas Kindler and Todd Martin and his wife Trish. So they're all going to be involved in these upcoming movies.
Cool. Very, 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 very interesting and very, very exciting. That's a lot of stuff that you've got coming out.
Yes, it is. There's last 2 years, there's been, you know, very much, you know, a lot more than I originally planned to do. So it just kind of fell into place. Part of it is was meeting Michelle Macabre because she's an actress and a special effects makeup person, and it's just really hard to get, you know, good people that are really into horror to do this stuff. So when you find somebody that's, you know, really passionate about it and wants to do the same thing you wanted to do, you're like, kind of jump on the opportunity and go, okay, let's do some stuff, because a lot of times, you know, people lose interest or it's hard to keep them going and motivated, or, you know, around, because there's not a lot of money doing this stuff. But so far, it's worked out really, really cool, and, you know, she stayed with it, so we're just kind of cranking out stuff as long as we can, you know, have the energy to do so around life and jobs and whatever else.
Well, yeah, you might as well do it while you can, instead of waiting until later.
Definitely, yes.
Well, one thing that I wanted to discuss that some people may not know about you is that you actually wrote 2 novels. And the one was called The Hammer Will Fall, and that was in 1999, which also had a publishing in South Korea, which is pretty interesting. And then the other novel was Unreal, in, I believe it was 2004. What was that like, being able to actually write a novel? And would you rather write a novel or a screenplay?
I've always been a fan of like Jack Ketchum, Stephen King, Richard Layman, you know, all those kind of guys growing up. So I'd always planned to do that, like a Richard Bachman book. So it was just awesome finally to do that. And I've, you know, writing, you know, whether it's a book or a screenplay, I love to write. And I think The Hammer Will Fall was originally a script that I could not and have not been able to get produced yet. So finally I just said, you know what, I'm going to make this a novel. So that's kind of how that evolved. And it's actually based on a lot of real things that my dad went through as an industrial arts teacher. That I saw and that, you know, we talked about when I was growing up, because, you know, he would come home from work after having these crazy adventures in the Florida school system, South Florida school system. And I kind of chronicled a lot of his stories into that book and then kind of mix-mashed it up with the class of 1984 concept where, you know, there's these bad kids and good teachers trying to help them, and they have to resort to violence to, you know, keep order in the school and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think it's really cool, and it's got a lot of my dad's old stories in there and situations, and it's got, I think, a really cool twist at the end. It could be a series of books, as a matter of fact. So, you know, it was really cool writing it and then actually seeing it get published and, you know, selling around the world. And that one did pretty good. Now, the one I did after that called Unreal didn't do as well. And then the company was, you know, again, when you get involved with publishers and you know, bigger business, they were kind of going a different route. They were a paying publisher where they were, you know, would pay you to write, you'd get checks and everything. And then suddenly they were asking you to pay them, and they became like a, I guess, I don't know what you would call that, a publisher that where you would pay them kind of to get the work out there, which there's a lot of, and there's nothing wrong with it if that's, you know, if you have the money to do that. And then, and of course, you can go like the Create Space route, you know, and all that. But yeah, so right. Unreal was like a kind of a fictional autobiography with that mixed just a lot of things that I'd done, the real stuff with kind of a fantasy action movie plot line. It's kind of very hard to describe, and it's a very strange novel, so it just didn't do as well. But I definitely like to do more. I'm planning maybe in the next year or two to try to do at least another novel or two just to get them out there. And then I did buy the rights back to those books, so I'm going to try to republish those at some point too, you know, when as time allows. So, but I mean, it was really good, and I got a lot of always interesting to get fans, you know, to read it and like it and, you know, and enjoy it. So, you know, that was kind of really cool because everybody's always like a closet Stephen King because, you know, he's like, that's what I kind of grew up on. So it was just kind of fun to join that little party in a small way.
Well, hey, you've been published, and you even have people in South Korea reading your work. So, and probably by now, even more than South Korea is reading your work. So,
correct.
Hey, you've arrived. You're all over the world.
That's right.
I mean, I'm sure you already knew that. You know you're doing well, but it's also nice when you're doing well that somebody tells you that you are.
Right, and you get good feedback. It's always a pleasure, you know, that people are enjoying it.
Right. Well, speaking of the fans, do you go to a lot of conventions, which I assume that you do, and if you do, do you like doing them, or are you just kind of, well, I should do it for the fans?
No, I love to do conventions. You know, I'm a fan myself. I mean, that's how really all this started. I'm just a diehard horror fan where
right.
It becomes an obsession, yeah, where you're like, you know, I don't want to just watch this. I want to join in on this action and, you know, become part of this even more, whether, you know, like some people get into cosplay and they go from there and then, you know, do other things. And some people make T-shirts or, you know, they join the party in whatever way they can or whatever their artistic talents and inclinations, you know, lead them. They make games. They sell memorabilia. But, yeah, I love the conventions. And even more than sitting at the table, I like to go, you know, meet my favorite, you know, people, whoever they may be, whether it's Kane Hodder or Robert Englund or, you know, all the classic staple people who, you know, are in the industry. But, yeah, I love the conventions, and I love to meet, you know, I've done many conventions, and it's just always an honor to, you know, meet people who are like-minded that like the work, and they come up and they know the movies and go, oh, that's one of the first movies I've ever rented. We rented that and we had a big sleepover with it. Everybody was scared to death. And Truth or Dare has that reputation. Truth or Dare and Killing Spree kind of have the reputation. A lot of people rented that at sleepovers, and it's a favorite. Some people watch it at family reunions every year over and over, like Truth or Dare. I've heard from people in Canada and Australia, and Canada had a really big release of, you know, Truth or Dare Critical Madness, so there's a lot of people that really have good nostalgic childhood memories of that movie. And Elijah Wood's a huge fan. He went on he went on a Twitter spree promoting the movie, and he was on like major talk shows talking about how it was the first horror movie he ever saw and inspired him. So again, you know, that was an honor to, you know, hear that, you know, that my movie affected somebody who's way bigger than I am. And, you know, that has been a really huge success. But, you know, one of the things that he loves the most about horror is Truth or Dare Critical Madness, because it's, you know, his bit of nostalgia when he was a kid. His brother introduced him to horror with, you know, the videotape of that movie. And there's many, many, many other directors working in the business and, you know, actors and other fans that, you know, were kind of drawn into it. And that never even occurred to me when I was doing it. But, you know, like 35 years later, you're like going, oh, wow, that happened, the longevity of the movie. And they still remember it and they still buy it. And but, yeah, I love the conventions. I love the, you know, meet the people. And hopefully if I make a little bit of money, I don't spend it all, you know, going around buying other people's movies and posters and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So.
Well, yeah, but you might as well make yourself happy. If you want to buy this stuff, buy this stuff.
That's right.
I bought all kinds of movies. I've had people say, why are you spending money on movies? And I said, well, why do you spend money on, and then whatever they spend their money on. One lady told me that I spend too much money on movies. And I said, you have a boat, and you're going to tell me I spend too much money on movies?
That's right. Well, everybody has their hobbies and their obsessions, so ours is movies and horror movies. So.
One thing I wanted to go over quickly, maybe not too quickly, because we have less than 9 minutes, but in 9 minutes you can get quite a few things in. So, but I did want to make sure that we talked about your behind-the-scenes documentaries that you have on your DVD releases, because they are pretty much legendary, because you make them long. They're not, like, short. And your scope, you cover a lot of things. You don't, like, just show up, this is real quick, and here's this, and just let me show you this for 2 seconds. And I've heard from many, many people that are starting in the film industry that they're very inspirational, these behind-the-scenes documentaries of yours. So they really are helping other people. And what made you start wanting to do that, just to help people to possibly be able to do what you do?
Definitely, yes. And also, you know, as a documentation of what it was to put each project together. And they're basically called the Blinded by the Blood series. And the inspiration behind them was Roy Frumke's Document of the Dead, which kind of is one of the ones that started all this, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff back in, 78. But it took forever for him to make that. But I actually saw when we were making Killing Spree, some of his film students had a rough cut of it. And it was still, it took him like 10, 15 years to finally, you know, actually finish that movie. But it was, when I saw it back in 1988, 87, somewhere in there, I was so inspired by it. I was like going, well, you know, we got it. And I'd already done one for Truth or Dare. And I was like going, well, we got to continue this. And the idea was just to show what it takes if you want to make a movie and document it. A lot of people turn around and say, well, you're an egomaniac with all this, but they're not understanding where I'm coming from. I take the movies that I make very seriously, because the process, you put all your blood, sweat, and tears and all the time and money and resources that you put into it. But I don't, you know, if I take it very seriously, they misinterpret sometimes and say, wow, this guy thinks he's big time. No, I never think I'm big time. It's just, I do take the work that I do seriously, and that's kind of, you know, gets misrepresented a little bit. Like the Making a Creep took a lot of heat because it's like this guy, but they're like 90-minute movies and they show every detail. And like even Creep Chronicles, Creep is not a pretty documentary, but because it kind of chronicles the entire making of the movie, all the way to where I get ripped off by these distributors that give me rubber checks, and how the movie actually lost money, you know, in the end. So they're very, you know, they show all the warts and wounds that you get the disappointments of everything. But then, you know, if you do another one, you're bouncing back and you just pick up the pieces and go again. So, but yeah, they're, you know, we haven't done a lot of them recently. Hopefully High Fear will have a couple little, you know, documentaries that will kind of represent this from the past, because now it's so commonplace, but this is really a good, you know, reflection on the past, on how it was to put together these things. And of course now with DVDs, everybody does these, the major studios do them. You know, they started doing them when, you know, you could put all that great extra material on there. And it's, you know, for the film fan, that's really, if you don't want to go to film school and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you can network on your own through social media and stuff, it's just great to watch movies, some that you may not ordinarily watch, and watch the making of stuff just to get kind of a rounded, education on how all these things are done and the shortcuts and the making of. So now you can just kind of do all that on with DVD and Blu-ray, especially. You can't really do that on streaming as much unless you subscribe to, like, the Criterion streaming channel will give you all those kind of extras and stuff. But most of the time, you know, the only way to get that is through, you know, physical media. So that's one of its huge benefits, I think.
Oh, yeah, I've mentioned that when people talk about, oh, streaming this and streaming that and blah, 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 and calling me an old fogey because I say I prefer physical media. I said it has nothing to do with being old. I said, as a matter of fact, I have nieces and nephews that are obviously younger than me, and some of them are like grand nieces and nephews that are like in their teens, and they prefer physical media, so it has nothing to do with my age.
Right. All right, definitely.
It's just what a preference is. Especially if you're going to be a collector, you can't collect something that's digital.
Yeah, you can't collect the air. And then, well, I had several accounts. I did that before, and then they would erase the channel, or they go out of business, and then all your digital, or the license runs out on a movie you buy and keep in the cloud, and then the cloud just sails over stormy waters and you lose it. So.
Right. And you've spent the money for it, and now you don't have it. At least if you spend money on something that's physical, you still have it. And then the biggest reason to get the physical media is because you can get it autographed.
That's right.
A digital copy autographed.
That is right. And you got the beautiful artwork and the poster replications and the flip. You know, the flip side, you can...
Right.
If you get a dual layer side where you can do the old retro one or the new artwork, and they got booklets in them and keepsakes, and of course all the making of stuff, and like Arrow and Scream Shout Factory, they send you posters with it, like the new Friday the 13th set they just announced today. It's like $200, but it's like 16 discs, and you know, you get two posters and all this stuff. So.
Well, we've got a little over 2 minutes, so I did want to make sure that you had a chance to tell people how to contact you, like if they just want to chat with you, or maybe they want to collaborate with you on something. If you could tell them the best way to contact you, now is your chance.
All right. Just look for me at www.timritter.com. You can email me from there, or I'm on Facebook as Movie Maker Tim Ritter, I think. So either one of those. I think I think I'm on Instagram as well and Twitter. So it's, you know, all that. If you go to my website, www.timritter.com, it's, you know, all that stuff's listed there. There's links on there. So
that's probably the best way for people that aren't already friends with you on Facebook and stuff to go to the website.
Yeah, or you can just probably type in Facebook, Movie Maker Tim Ritter, and it'll probably come up. I think it does if you do a Google search. If you do on my name, the Facebook site comes up first. So...
Yeah, one quick thing I wanted to say, because I actually wanted to say it earlier, but, you know, it wasn't absolutely necessary, so I let it go. But you have a title, The Godfather of Video Gore, and I just wanted to make sure to say that so that the people listening.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to have a title. I think Herschel Gordon Lewis was the godfather of gore. I think somebody just inserted video gore because I came after him. But definitely a big early influence for sure.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, he was one of the greats. And there's like 20 seconds left if you want to say anything really quickly.
Long live the new flesh.
You're funny. Yeah, one thing about Blog Talk Radio, you can go under, but you can't go over. So
can't
I'm
going to
be
over.
Hanging up because, they'll be cutting us off anyway. So
okay.
It was nice having you, Tim Ritter. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Take care.